but it won't be long. Cause kids with guns, kids with guns. Easy does it, easy does it. They got something to say.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rhys Ehrlich, a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. He has an article at Global Post, Saudi Youth Fighting Against Assad Regime in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rhys Ehrlich.
A real pleasure to be here, Ian.
And this, of course, is we've seen this movie before where these repressive regimes in the Middle East, whether they're military dictatorships or corrupt monarchies, they ship their dissidents off in, of course, to Afghanistan. The Egyptian dictators, the Moroccan dictators, they emptied their jails and the CIA and the Pakistani ISI welcomed these freedom fighters, the Mujahideen, and of course we suffered the blowback eventually with Al Qaeda. So I suppose it's not a surprise, but it's still pretty brazen, isn't it? In this day and age, to be doing the same thing, where if you're a young dissident in Saudi Arabia and you get arrested by the police, you basically offered a ticket out of jail if you go and fight in Syria.
Yeah, it's pretty brazen, and I guess unless you're authorities in Saudi Arabia, in which case it's just common sense. My story, I reported from Saudi Arabia and from sources inside Syria. The most serious part of it is that the people who are going are not just going to join whatever democratic-minded group they might be able to find in Syria. They're going to join the most extremist of the factions over there, al-Nusra and some similar groups. And they do it out of ideological solidarity, if you will. And it's running directly counter to the at least ostensible U.S. policies in Syria, which is to oppose those kind of groups. So here an alleged U.S. ally is funding and arming people who are fighting against the goals of the rebellion in Syria.
Well, I think duplicity is no surprise when it comes to Saudi Arabia. I mean, for example, the Saudi king was apparently during the Mubarak period before he was toppled. He was on the phone every day screaming at Obama to shoot the kids in Tahrir Square, and then the Saudis funded the Salafists in the parliamentary elections, and they came out of nowhere and came in second place. Somehow or other, our government doesn't seem to notice this duplicity or be prepared to do anything about it. But tell us about this extraordinary case of this young Saudi who was arrested for anti-government activities, and then the judge took him into chambers along with, I think 19 of young dissidents altogether, and they were basically encouraged to go and fight the jihad in Syria. And then it took his father to sue the authorities when he learned that his son had died in Syria?
Yes. This took place in a city in northern Saudi Arabia towards the end of last year. And it's a documented case because the father was so outraged about what happened to his 19-year-old son that he wrote a letter of complaint to the king about the judge and the activities of the judge. And surprisingly, he hasn't heard anything back from the king about it. But that appears to be the tip of the iceberg. There have been other reports of people allowed to leave jail, other reports of people being encouraged to go, wealthy Saudis funding groups of people. So far, it's in the hundreds. It hasn't reached anything close to what it was like with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. But it's quite troubling, nonetheless.
But Reese Ehrlich, there's also this pattern, is there not, with wealthy Saudis operating as cutouts or surrogates for the Saudi government. The Saudi government can complain, sure, say to the American government, we're not doing this, but this is just volunteer. Right.
And that's exactly the argument of the Saudi government. I interviewed officials with the Saudi government, and they say it's absolutely illegal for people to go and fight in Syria. We forbid it. Our highest leading mullah has issued a fatwa against it. But we can't control what people do if they leave the country as tourists. And if they go to Istanbul and then make their way to the Syrian border, there's nothing we can do about it. So it leaves a rather wide loophole. And, of course, if nothing goes on in Saudi Arabia at this level without at least the tacit government approval. So if you're wealthy, and this is, by the way, not just only in Saudi Arabia, but in Libya and Tunisia and other parts of the Middle East, there's these jihadists flocking to Syria and specifically not fighting at home for democracy or for human rights.
Again, I'm speaking with Reese Ehrlich, a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy, and the Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. He has an article at the Global Post, Saudi Youth Fighting Against Assad Regime in Syria. Now, apparently, quite a lot of arms are now suddenly funneled to the opposition, and mostly by the Saudis and the Qataris. The CIA has a presence in there, and they're supposedly training the Free Syrian Army in Jordan. But apparently, these big Russian-made MLRS and Hurricane launchers capable of firing batteries of 220-millimeter rockets. The Shmurs, etc., they're apparently showing up, and there's a substantial battle going on over the Nirab air base at the Aleppo's airport, where a lot of Russian and Iranian cargo planes are bringing in arms around the clocks. So there's a quantitative change that's going on. But my understanding is that at the summit, the Arab summit that just was underway in Doha, Qatar, there's been some friction between the Saudis and the Qataris. It's nothing new about that. But
yeah,
what's going on?
Well, the Qataris back the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood, as your listeners probably know, is a conservative Islamist group. But in the case of the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, they are committed to a parliamentary system, to holding some kind of elections, to having their right to have some kind of free press and organized trade unions, etc. At least that's what they say. That's too much for the Saudis. They would prefer to have a military guy come in and impose a new dictatorship. My sources in Saudi Arabia told me that their model is what happened in Yemen, where you have the old dictator thrown out, but a new dictator come in who came in from the military. The problem with that, of course, is it's not going to work in Syria. There's nobody in the Syrian military who's defected or has the capability of doing something like that. So the Saudis, as a backup, go to these more extremist groups, Salafists, whatever you want to call them, people who believe not in a parliamentary system, but in a system of a caliphate, where a Islamic dictatorship would be imposed on the country. Elections are not held, et cetera, et cetera. And it's rule. You have something like the old Ottoman Empire or the old Arab empires of old. And so the Saudis are pushing those factions, and the Qataris are pushing the Muslim Brotherhood, as is the Turkish government. And that's a point of friction. They all want to get rid of Assad, but once Assad is gone, then we're going to see the real infighting going on amongst these various factions.
Well, there's already been some incidents of the Farouk Brigade's leader. One of them was shot by the al-Nusra people. So
yes.
I guess what's happening now is sort of round one, right?
It is indeed. And these folks are really sectarian. It's like my way or the highway. For those people involved in the social movements in the U.S., and you've seen some groups act in a really sectarian way. Well, imagine if those people had Kalashnikovs. Oh, boy. Anyway, the good news in Syria is that while these extremist groups have been picking up strength, and particularly when they receive arms, they have a certain amount of success because they are fighting the Assad government, they do not have much political support. Groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, like the civil society groups, have a much larger popular base. And if there is ever a chance to hold some free elections, or something close to free elections anyway, I think these groups are going to show that they don't have much popular support.
So is there any pushback coming from the U.S. government against what the Saudis are doing? And if the Turks and the Qataris both want the Muslim Brotherhood, and yet, from my understanding, is these arms that the Saudis are getting from the Balkans are coming by road through Turkey, and that that Prince Bandar, the head of Saudi intelligence, apparently basically had to threaten the Turks, you know, that we buy an awful lot of your stuff, you know. Is that what's going on, just a raw black?
There's a lot of backstabbing and lying to each other. Right. Everybody claimed, I mean, the official Saudi line, the official U.S. line, the official Turkish line is we are backing the moderate and nationalist forces. You'll see that in New York Times articles recently that are based out of Washington. The problem is they're simply lying about it, and the U.S. knows that the Saudis are lying about it. I've talked to sources in Washington. But there's all kinds of other reasons that they're not going to go after the Saudis on this one. You know, there's the oil, of course. There's the general political support that they need from the Saudis in the region, and so on and so forth. So the U.S. knows what the Saudis are up to, but they're not going to make an issue out of it, at least so far.
Even though if you really did an inventory of the history of the price that the U.S. has paid for Saudi duplicity, you know, you've got who the Saudis helped create the Taliban. They've radicalized.
They had 19 of the flyers, the people who attacked on 9/11.
Right. I was about to say.
Plane hijackers, not, you know, just right. A minor detail.
And then, of course, they've radicalized Pakistan. Now they're trying to turn Syria into the Somalia of the Mediterranean. You know,
if I was sitting in the State Department, you would have just convinced me, and I would have shifted U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia. But for some reason, the people in Washington ain't changing. They're sticking with Saudis just like they stick with Israel, and there's all kinds of larger economic, political, geostrategic, military factors at play, and they're willing to tolerate this stuff in order to keep the oil flowing and so on.
And not to mention that the Saudis, through the Wahhabis, have succeeded in foisting a kind of extremely conservative and austere version of Islam all around the world.
They back the most extremist forces who they're not interested in even the pretense of democracy. I mean, to them, elections is a bad idea.
Sure. Well, you've got this father whose 19-year-old son was killed in Syria. The best he can do is write a letter to the king. That's all you can do in Saudi Arabia.
That's right.
That's Saudi democracy.
Yep.
So what's your sense then of how long this agony is going to go on? Because this, the key air base that I mentioned in Aleppo, you know, we could end up with both. I know the Iranians are already in there, the IRGC, but isn't it possible that the Free Syrian Army and maybe even the Russians are going to be going at it soon?
Well, I think it's still a surrogate war. I think first of all, nobody knows for sure. You know, we're going off press reports, all of which have their own biases. I've heard no credible reports that the Iranians have large numbers of troops in Syria. They have advisors, they have people working with the intelligence services, etc. Mm. Hezbollah has some fighters there. I don't think the Russians are going to send in troops. That would be just crazy. If anything, they're trying to back away a little bit from Assad. The Turks are not going to send in their troops. They prefer, everyone prefers to use proxies. And so we're going to see fighting mainly among Syrians, with some hundreds of foreign fighters involved on one side or the other. But, you know, I was in Syria in 2011, about 6 months after the uprising began, and people were telling me it was just a matter of months before Assad would be out of power. And here we are over 2 years later. I think the Syrian government has proven to have more support than people had anticipated.
Sure.
And he's played the religion card, and he's played the ethnic card. And
the foreign interference card, et cetera.
And the foreign interference card.
Right.
Foreign interference. which makes people quite angry.
Right. Well, we've run out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us, Reese Ehrlich.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Reese Ehrlich, veteran correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorist Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. He has an article at the Global Post, Saudi Youth Fighting Against Assad Regime in Syria. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the reversal of democracy in Thailand, Venezuela, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Russia.
So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now?